This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
There is a new panic on the alt-right. They warn the United States could be planning a first-strike nuclear attack on Russia. Infamous radio show Alex Jones loves to cover the alleged plot, and former Reagan cabinet member Paul Craig Roberts is practically screaming about it. So should we worry about nuclear war again? I was suspicious, until I found the real data published in a well-respected Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. The lead author is Hans M. Christensen. He is the director of the Nuclear Information Project with the Federation of American Scientists. Oxford University Press publishes his assessments as part of an annual review of global nuclear forces. Christensen is the author of two books on nuclear affairs. From Washington, Hans Christensen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
President Donald Trump promised to fund the development of new nuclear weapons, but long before he took office, according to your article, America gained a critical edge with something called the burst height compensating superfuse. What the heck is that?
Well, that's a fancy name we've given it, except for the first part, the burst height compensation fuse. It is a technology that has been in the U.S. arsenal for a while on one of the Navy's submarine warheads. But what has happened is that this increased targeting capability has also been added to a second warhead that's on the submarine. And those warheads are in far greater numbers. And so what we now have is a situation where all the warheads on all the submarines are now capable of being used against what's called the hardened targets.
And you've tracked the path towards this technology of more accurate nuclear strikes for quite a while, and it sounds to me like it may have started all the way back in the 1990s. Is that correct?
That's correct. This particular project, this particular upgrade of the latest warhead that we're describing in our article, that development started all the way back in the Clinton administration. And it was sort of, you know, a part of an overhaul and a long-term planning where the warhead was supposed to come out and not have significantly new capabilities. But they managed to add this component to it that increases not its accuracy, but its efficiency in terms of killing targets, basically.
I know that Vladimir Putin publicly complained that America broke the balance of power based on mutually assured destruction. On July 13, 2002, the United States withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, or the ABM Treaty, which had been in force since 1972. Was ending the treaty, do you think, related to an American desire to develop more advanced nuclear capability?
No, I don't think so. I think what drove that was a dream about building a ballistic missile defense system to some extent, not for the purpose of being able to sort of have a, in the good old Reagan vision, a seal over the United States that warheads couldn't penetrate, but they wanted to have capabilities against regional adversaries and their ballistic missiles. That work has still not produced a ballistic missile defense system that is, you know, proof certain to work after a lot of money. No, I think the issue is on the issue of the warhead upgrades. That's sort of a separate issue. That when you modernize weapons, quite often you see new technologies being built into them, and they can, in some cases, significantly enhance the capability of these warheads, just like we're seeing now with this particular warhead.
And I read through your article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It was published March 1st, 2017. Everybody should read it. And I got the idea that this more accurate or more powerful detonation system frees up other nukes, and that could, in fact, kind of double the nuclear strength of the American arsenal. Is that an accurate picture?
Sort of. I mean, the point is that the, again, it's not the accuracy. It's the kill efficiency. And the way they do this is that the previous warhead, before it was life extended, had a fuse that had three settings. One was ground burst, the one was sort of an optimum height of burst, and the third was very high altitude. In this one, they have sort of a flexible fuse that can go off at any particular height. And so that enables the warfighters to get more warheads statistically close to the target so that they can destroy it. So what we now have is that overall, like you said, a significant increase in the overall lethality, if you will, or kill capability of the submarine force. And so, you know, some people will read into this, like the headline you quoted up first, dramatic things like that the U.S. is planning a first strike and things like that. I don't think that's the case. But it nonetheless wants to have a superior capability. And with this one, they can now free up warheads that previously were earmarked to only target these hardened targets to do more demanding tasks. So it is a way of making the remaining weapons that are in the stockpile, even though there are overall fewer of them, it is a way of making the remaining weapons more efficient so they can cover more different scenarios and be more flexible, if you will.
You added a bit of controversy by suggesting nuclear war may be a greater and more imminent threat than climate change. Is that what you think?
Let's put it in this way, that climate change is happening. It's real. It's unfolding as we speak. Nuclear war is not. We have dangers that it could if things go wrong, of course. And so it's about avoiding those dangers translating into real events. So they're two different things, but they are the two different issues that can, I'd say, unlike any other phenomenon we know of, threaten the survival of human beings. And so that is a particularly daunting task to try to avoid that these matters don't get out of hand.
And you mentioned that this fuse helps them decide where the bomb may go off in the atmosphere. And on Radio EcoShock, we've been delving into the use of nuclear weapons detonated in space to destroy electronics on the ground using an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. Is that a completely different subject than you're covering in your bulletin article?
Yes, it is. What we're looking at is what happens when the warheads come in from space at very high speed and this cone-shaped re-entry vehicle moves toward its target. When it comes closer to the target, it has to be able to know, so to speak, at which point to go off. And like I said, in the past, they had three fixed fuses for this particular system. One would just go off when it hit the ground. One would go off when it got to a certain height. And the other one could go off in a much higher altitude, like, for example, to create the EMP effect that you mentioned. But in this case, what they've changed is that the radar on the warhead is able to read, so to speak, where it is and more accurately detonate the weapon at the optimum height of burst that is needed to create this peak pressure that destroys the target. And this is a warhead, of course, that's always been able to use against, you know, soft surface targets. But because of this new capability, it can also now go after hardened underground targets like ICBM silos that are underground and a bit hardened to withstand certain pressures from the detonating warheads. So it is an enhanced capability that has sort of been, you know, that has crept into the arsenal in a much broader scale than it used to be. And by the way, this is just the submarine force. They're also updating the fuses on the land-based ballistic missiles, the ICBMs. So they will get the same capability in the future as well.
Yes, you're talking about the submarines at this time, and I'm hearing the Pentagon is working to double the range of the Tomahawk missile, and that means nuclear bombs could reach Moscow from submarines far at sea. Have you heard about that?
Submarines at sea, ballistic missile submarines, of course, can already hit all over Russia or any other country for that matter. They have very long-range ballistic missiles. The Tomahawk missiles you talk about are cruise missiles. They have a range of something in the order of, you know, 2,500 kilometers, the way it is right now. They no longer have warheads for them. They used to have nuclear warheads, but those warheads were retired. So all of those Tomahawk cruise missiles today are conventional only.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Now, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists originated the so-called Doomsday Clock, and in January of this year, of 2017, the clock was set at 2.5 minutes to midnight. That's the closest to catastrophe we've seen since 1953 when the Soviets detonated a hydrogen bomb. Why is it so dangerous now?
Well, so I'm not part of the board or the group that determines whether to move forward or whatever the clock and the arms on the clock there. But my understanding is that it's a combination of factors. They not only look at nuclear issues, but they also look, of course, on climate change. And so because of these crises, and I think right now, of course, there's a deterioration of relations between the United States and NATO on the one side and then Russia on the other, and also between U.S. and China and the South China Sea, as well as the relations with North Korea in general and their nuclear weapons programs. I think their thinking was that all of this adds up to a much more dangerous world, and therefore it was time to move the arms a little closer to midnight.
Hans Christensen, you have published a few times on new nuclear weapons tech developing in the United States. Have you been tracking the Russian response?
Yes. Well, Russia, is, for its own sake, is in the middle of its own large modernization program. All nuclear weapon states go through these phases where they upgrade their nuclear arsenals. We did ours in the United States back in the 1980s and early 90s. So we don't have to do it for a few years, but we're now beginning to plan the next cycle. And Russia started their earlier modernization before we did, and so they are now over halfway through their modernization cycle. So these cycles don't happen at the same time. So it's kind of hard to say that the modernization is a response to, direct response to. I think this has to be looked at over a long period of time. It can certainly shape their perception about what the United States is up to. And we know from Russian official statements, of course, that they're, you know, somewhat paranoid, almost certainly convinced that the United States is out to gain some type of, if not first strike, then certainly winnable military strategy and capabilities. So they're looking, from their perspective, at all these capabilities, both on the nuclear, but also on the long-range conventional precision strike, as well as ballistic missile defense systems and cyber attack and what have you. And it seems that for them, it all adds up to the United States trying to get them, so to speak. So this is one of the issues that, of course, we're pointing out here, that on the one hand, it's important if you want to have deterrence and for it to work, that it's credible. On the other hand, you have to be careful that your modernization programs don't become so good and so capable that you begin to plan doubt in the mind of an adversary about whether you're actually going to strike first. So this is a really fine balance that one has to be very careful about.
Do you think the Russians have a superfuse? And if not, can we expect them to have them soon?
I don't know if they have exactly the same technology, but they certainly have a long history of a program as well, you know, almost as old as ours in terms of ballistic missiles. And they've developed numerous types of warheads over the years for those. So they have a very advanced fuse technology, warhead technologies, just like we do. So it might be that they have something similar. I don't know, but I haven't seen it in particular. But they're certainly developing other forms of advanced reentry vehicles. For example, maneuverable reentry vehicles have been tested over the last several years. And the expectation is that the next large ballistic missile they're going to deploy, which probably at the beginning of next decade, which is called the Sarmat, that it will have an advanced payload, or some of them will have an advanced payload that can maneuver. And the motivation, at least what they're saying now, is that that is needed for them because of the U.S. building advanced ballistic missile defense systems, so their warheads have to be able to sort of fool this ballistic missile defense system. There is an arms race, not in terms of numbers, because the numbers are not going up, but there's a technological arms race on the nuclear level where the countries are quite clearly competing against each other with countermeasures and what have you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Hans M. Christensen. He's the director of the Nuclear Information Project and a published expert on world nuclear weapons. Hans, do you think there are people in the Pentagon who might seriously argue a first strike against Russia could be, well, quotes, successful?
No, I don't think so. There are far too many uncertainties about achieving a successful first strike, certainly against a large adversary like Russia. So even though you could hypothetically develop a capability where you would have the capability to knock out all of their forces, due to sheer physics, there's no way you could ever be 100% certain that you would knock out everything. So you could not rule out some limited form of retaliation. But I also think, I really seriously doubt that in the U.S. military planning there is any interest in considering anything that looks like a surprise first strike against Russia or anything like that. That's not to say that they don't have very capable forces and offensive strike plans that can, according to those plans, do very specific type of damage against the different aspects of their nuclear infrastructure and military infrastructure. But the objective here is not to create a surprise first strike or a so-called decapitating strike where they can just fire everything and then win the war.
Do you think it's possible the Trump administration could order a nuclear strike against North Korea?
If so, it would be a phenomenal mistake. But unfortunately, the President of the United States has the authority to launch such a strike if he deems it necessary. There's no requirement for him to check in with anyone else. There's no one else that has to approve it. He can wake up one day and say, now we do it. And there's no one who can legally stop him. So that's a very worrisome situation that any person, single person, should ever have such a capability. Having said that, of course, what worries me more is, I mean, it's not that he wakes up one day and suddenly decides now he has to nuke North Korea. I think the issue here is more whether his personality is a good fit for a serious crisis that requires complex thinking and strategy and patience. He doesn't seem to be really well equipped to deal with those situations. And so there is a concern, of course, that through a series of blunders, we could sort of stumble into a crisis that gets worse and escalates to nuclear use. And then in that case, you could end up in a corner where someone decided that it was necessary to use nuclear weapons. So that's more the concern I have.
Well, getting back to the larger possibility of an exchange of nuclear weapons in bigger countries, I've seen a scientific paper which analyzed the nuclear winter effect of a limited exchange of nuclear weapons between India and Pakistan.
Yes.
Surely an American first strike against Russia, as the alt-right is talking about, would boomerang into a nuclear winter that starves us all.
Oh, yeah, that's totally crazy talk. So it's like, you know, I mean, there's always been people who sort of talk about this, but I think it's important to emphasize these are not people that are representing any form of what you could call the responsible military planning that is going on. There are issues with that, and we can discuss that, of course, but we're not in this kind of cuckoo era where they're seriously contemplating that kind of stuff. So I think that's just, it's very much a fringe type of point of view that does not reflect what's actually going on.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. So do you think the United States has more nuclear escalation in development?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is the nature of all modernization programs, that they increase the capabilities. That's not just for nuclear, but also conventional. We're in this never-ending cycle. We've been in it since World War II. All countries are trying to get better at using nuclear weapons, more efficient, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is going on, and the next generation weapons will be more capable than the ones we have. And, of course, they will further fuel concerns abroad among adversaries that, you know, well, they better do something too. But again, I don't want to say that it's the United States that drives this development. All the nuclear weapon states are doing their own dirty work, so to speak. And it's just that it feeds this type of endless worst-case scenario thinking and suspicion, and it doesn't seem to stop. It just doesn't seem to stop. So I don't know how to break that cycle. But yes, we're going through the next round of modernization. It will create new capabilities, absolutely.
All right. Well, let's look at another country. I gather you've written both reports and a book on Chinese nuclear forces. Can China threaten America with nuclear weapons?
Yes, it certainly can. China has not very many, but compared to the United States and Russia, but we estimate they have something in the order of 250 to 70 nuclear warheads in their stockpile. And about probably 80 to 90 of those are on long-range ballistic missiles that can hit various parts of the United States. Some can cover the entire country, a portion of it. And you don't need thousands of nuclear weapons to cause extraordinary destruction and damage. I mean, if just those less than 100 warheads that are on their long-range ballistic missile that can hit the United States, if they were ever used, it would be the end of the United States as we know it. Just think back. The havoc and confusion and crisis that two airplanes flying in a couple of buildings in New York and one in the Pentagon, what that created in 2001. And that was nothing compared to what just one nuclear warhead will create. So that is just to emphasize here that even small arsenals have really troublesome capabilities of being able to cause enormous damage. That's why nuclear weapons are so unique and in a different category than any other kind of weapons that we know of. So yes, China can threaten the United States. And again, it's a smaller country, but again, we cannot rule out. Of course, we couldn't probably conduct a surprising first strike and be certain that all of their launchers would be destroyed. So something would probably survive and be able to be launched against us. So that's again to say that, you know, even a small arsenal can be a formidable deterrent.
Does China have a credible missile defense system?
No, they do not. Not yet, at least. But they're working on it. They're developing their own interceptors and conducting various, experiments. We do know that the American ballistic missile defense system has already had a significant impact on the way the Chinese think about their needs for how many nuclear weapons and of what kind they need for their nuclear deterrent. So what we've seen recently is that they have started deploying multiple warhead capability on their long-range ballistic missiles. So instead of just one warhead per missile, you have up to three. So that's an attempt to overwhelm or confuse, if you will, an American ballistic missile defense system. So that's already having effects there. But even though they complain about that, they themselves are already also beginning to develop ballistic missile defense systems, probably more in the sort of to give them capabilities in smaller scenarios against maybe India in those kind of scenarios. But everybody's doing something on this issue.
Well, I know that nuclear weapons development has continued with both the Democratic and the Republican parties. They all agree on it. They spend zillions of dollars to keep it going. Do you think the nuclear drive is an unstoppable social force?
It certainly seems that way, but that's not to say you can't influence it. We just have to go back a decade and sort of remember when the Obama administration came in, there definitely was a new sort of talk in town. There was definitely a new mood about prospects for, if not complete elimination, then certainly significant reductions of nuclear forces. Since then, things have changed a bit, but it still hasn't changed enough that nuclear weapons arsenals in the United States and Russia are increasing. I just want to emphasize that yes, there is a crisis and they're both modernizing, but we're still not at a point where they're building up nuclear arsenals again. So I think what's really important now with the new administration here in the United States is that this kind of loose talk we've seen on Trump's Twitter account about enhancing the numbers and capabilities of U.S. nuclear weapons, we may have to be very careful that we do not get into yet another arms race in terms of numbers here with the Russians. Fortunately, the U.S. military has been quite clear so far that they do not need more nuclear weapons. They have more than they need already, more than they need to safeguard the United States and its allies. In fact, the Pentagon has itself concluded several years ago that they could do with up to one-third fewer nuclear weapons than we have today, and they would still be able to do what they have to do. So that's just to say that there's no need to build up. There's no need to increase the arsenal.
Well, among politicians, we have heard the argument that we need new nukes, maybe tactical nukes or precision little ones or something, because nations we label rogue are becoming nuclear capable. They point to North Korea and Iran. Do you buy that?
No, not one bit. The point being here that those countries, or some of them, have been developing these capabilities for decades. That hasn't cost us to conclude that we therefore need new lower legal nuclear weapons. I think what's happening now is that we're in a crisis situation with the Russians, and that has changed the political discussion. So now it's easier for people who already wanted to have new nuclear weapons previously but couldn't quite get through in the political debate. Now they have a voice. Fortunately, I think, again, the military circumstances have not changed. There is plenty of flexible capability in the current nuclear arsenal. And the military, in a way, has really moved away from this idea that you need to have this tit-for-tat capability. It's not about, you know, exactly what kinds of weapons you have. It is what strategic effects they can bring to bear. And in this case, they say they have plenty of flexibility and different levels of use options in the current arsenal that they do not need to get new nuclear weapons.
Well, Fox News host Joe Scarborough, sort of a third-party thing, said that Trump had asked, well, what's the use of having nuclear weapons if you can't use them? That's a pretty tough question, and I'm hoping that somebody has since informed him why, but does it worry you?
It certainly worries me that the president we currently have seems to have a minuscule understanding of both nuclear weapons, even the very arsenal that he's the commander-in-chief of, but certainly also about the role of nuclear weapons, both historically, but also the role that they play today. So if you hear these statements that come out of him from once in a while, they seem to come from a different place, sort of a very simplistic mindset. When it's about nuclear weapons, I think we just have to be extraordinarily careful that the president does not sort of belittle the concern about nuclear weapons use. It is the policy of this nation that nuclear non-use has to be maintained. We have an extraordinary accomplishment that has now lasted 72 years since 1945, that we have not had use of nuclear weapons in anger anywhere in the world since those days. That is an achievement we have to hold on to and ensure that that continues, and that requires responsible behavior on the part of the President of the United States as well.
What is the Federation of American Scientists?
It's a group of scientists that started off in the nuclear weapons program back in the 1940s. They were developing the nuclear weapons, but the program was so secretive that they were not allowed to talk to each other, the scientists between the different laboratories that worked on it. So they created them what they called the Federation of Atomic Scientists, and they published a magazine. It was called the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. That magazine still exists today as an independent magazine, and I write a column in it. But over the years, of course, the Federation of American Scientists became this arms control advocacy group, if you will, that used scientific analysis to analyze the role of nuclear weapons, monitor who's got what and where is it and what's the trend, and also come up with recommendations for how it's possible to reduce the dangers of nuclear weapons.
As we wrap up, is there any take-home message you would like to leave in the minds of our listeners?
I would just urge that when people read the newspapers, that they don't get swept away in this sort of the feeling of crisis and the Russians are coming, the Chinese are coming, the North Koreans are coming, and sort of forget and leap into quick decisions about increasing the role of nuclear weapons or building more of them, etc. I think it's important that we try to stay the course and reduce the role of nuclear weapons, of course, not just in our own strategy, but also try to influence how other nuclear weapons states see the role of, and their requirements for nuclear weapons.
We've been talking with Hans M. Christensen under the umbrella of the Federation of the American Scientists. Hans directs the Nuclear Information Project, and we've been talking about a new article published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. You can find the Atomic Scientists at thebulletin.org. The title of this provoking article is How the U.S. Nuclear Force Modernization is Undermining Strategic Stability, the Burst Height Compensating Superviews, with co-authors Matthew McKinsey and Theodore A. Postol. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Hans, thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.